Hello, podcast listeners. You are currently listening to Stories Past, stories told to students by me, Blake Smith, over the last 30 years. Okay, we're back for another episode of Stories Past, but in this particular story, this is a story I've been telling for a while, and it actually isn't my own story. And this story is the story of Václav Satolla and how he got to the United States. And it's a great story, and therefore I invited Vas to come on and tell us his story. So thank you, Vas, for coming. Sure. And I'm just going to ask you a few questions to get you started, but you, of course, can just jump in and change the story whichever way you want to. We're coming back from break. We have a few episodes already in there, but this is an exciting one, so I'm looking forward to it. So Václav, if you can, I'm going to kind of lead you with questions, but if you just want to go with it, and we went over some of these questions here, but you know, I think first the people would probably like to know, you know, where were you born and where you grew up, and what was your kind of family relationship before you left?
All right. So I was born in Prague, Czechoslovakia, which is the capital of Czechoslovakia. And you would probably call it a comfortably middle-class family. I had a father, I had a mother, grandparents. We had an apartment in the city. We had a summer house in about 20 miles outside of town. So it was not a terrible place to be born with two parents. And I was able to... Because I was born with some kind of a defect in my hip. My parents always steer me towards sports. And the sport that I picked that did not hurt my hip was actually swimming. So early in my life, I became a swimmer and became a pretty good one at the end. And that made me a really good, decent bunch of friends who influenced me positively, actually. In my neighborhood school, I'm not sure how I would end up, but I was able to go to something that you would probably call prep school for swimming. And that's where I met I was going there with all the kids of the lawyers and movers and shakers, doctors and stuff like that. And so for them, it was like, you know, normal foregone conclusion that they will go to college after high school. They were not going to go and start doing something else. So I was influenced very positively by my friends.
And you had to pay for that? No.
No, this was all under communism. It was all free.
Okay? How about your ownership of your summer home?
That was interesting. So the summer home is a phenomena of Eastern Europeans. And somehow, even under communism, they were able to buy small plots of land and build a shack on it or a house on it or something like that. But our summer house was a little different. My grandfather, was a very well regarded pastry maker in Prague. He was doing well. He was raking it in. And so he was just going to buy a house on Václav Square, which is the main thoroughfare in downtown Prague, when 1948 happened and the communists took over. So he was doing really well. He was able to buy a large plot of land. It's about an acre. It was about an acre at the time. And he built a two-bedroom home on it, made out of cinder blocks and stuff like that. It was a regular house, unlike other summer houses. And then when they took everything away from him in 1948, he was able to keep that, which was a miracle. Yeah.
Did they take from him?
They took away the pastry making business. And they, of course, offered him that he could stay there and run it. And he says, no, thank you. So his next job, they assigned him a job as an electrician, as a lineman. Okay, so you're talking probably he was in his 40s at that time. I'm not sure, in 1948. And so he's climbing on the poles, doing wires as a lineman. And I guess he fell. And he did something to his body. I'm not sure what. You know, he was my grandfather. He was a godly figure for me. Sure. So even if he had any kind of physical problems, I never saw them. But he was able to do that. And they retired him into it. as an invalid, as a or the disability. So I only know him as an older person who was disabled, even though I never saw him being disabled. Anyway, but he was able to keep the summer home, which was a blessing because we still have it in our family right now.
Great.
Okay. So how did I get there? I'm not sure, but that's where that's where I grew up.
Okay. About your life as a teenager? So you said you swam.
I swam.
And you went to prep school, kind of preparing you for college, sort of.
Yeah. And so we, you know, we were doing the things that all teenagers do. We went out. You're talking 1970s. So we were dancing, you know, John Travolta, Saturday Night Fever.
Which I just played for my class, by the way. It's unbelievable you said that. I was just playing it.
That was my time. Yeah. We were wearing the leisure suits. Sure. Oh, my God.
Yeah, me too.
It was funny. And we went to discos all the time. So did I live a life of dread? I didn't, really. I didn't. It was the politics, and it was the way that my life would probably stop at some point where I would not be able to go any further. Because just to bring it home, if you were a son or grandson of somebody like my grandfather, you had a little bit of a black mark by your name. And if you were applying to go to college, you would really have to be a super genius to make it, because otherwise they would give the spot to somebody who was politically connected. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So
very interesting.
That's how it worked. So in Czechoslovakia,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but was your grandfather bitter about losing his pastry shop?
He probably was, and it killed him. It killed him in 1968 So between 1948 and 1966, it was terrible for him. But then in 1966, Dubček became the prime minister, and there was a period when everything was like easing up. The grip on the power of the communists were going away. So my grandfather, had a hope that maybe they'll give him the shop back. But then in 1968, the Warsaw Pact came back, invade Czechoslovakia, and that was the end of it. And my grandpa actually died in 1968 at the age of 60. And we think that it just, it was heart problem, it was this and that. We think it was just like he just gave up.
Did you know anyone, or your parents or father know anyone who was killed in Prague Spring?
No. It was surprisingly bloodless.
Yeah.
It was surprisingly bloodless. There were about three people who died that we know of, and they died mainly by mistake. You know, the Russian soldier or some soldier discharged his rifle because he was maybe cleaning it or something like that. Mm. Really, it was never malicious.
Interesting.
So they did not come in to kill anyone. They were surprisingly restrained. When people were, you know, trying to talk to them, or stick brooms into the tank, the cannon. Of the tank, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So no, I only know about one person who burned himself to death, Jan Palach, who was a student, and he did it as a protest.
I see.
He went to Václav Square, where the horse is on top. And he poured gasoline over himself, and he burned himself. And then they tried, people who were around him stopped the fire, but he was burned so badly that I think within about half a year he died. They could not stop him. But it was a protest. He was not killed by soldiers.
Right.
But in 1968, I remember I was at that summer house that I told you about. And so I was there with my grandfather, and my parents went for some vacation. Grandpa was watching me. And grandma was somewhere. I'm not sure. Maybe she was there too. And so I'm in my bedroom, and I turn on the radio at 7 in the morning when I woke up, and I hear tank number 25 is moving towards the trees, left side on the Václav Square. Well, citizens, watch out because it's dangerous. And I was like, what's going on? I was 9 years old. I was not terribly old, but I said, something is going on. So I woke up grandpa, something is going on. So he came, we listened to the radio, and he says, you know, They're coming. They're here. The Russians are coming.
Wow.
And at the same time, we heard airplanes overhead. And you imagine the C-130 that goes in Schenectady, the big ones. Okay. Those are the airplanes that were flying over us towards Prague, filled with jeeps, tanks, and stuff like that. And then we looked at the road, and other tanks were actually coming through our village towards Prague. So I was right there, and Grandpa says, "Put the fire out! Put the fire out!" Because we were burning fire in the, for the kitchen to cook. Yeah. He says, "Make sure that they don't see that we are here." You know, stuff like that.
Well, it's great, Voss, because what you've done now is you've set yourself up for telling about your escape, because or you're leaving Czechoslovakia, because you've told us that there were some bad things that went on, but that your life was not
my
that
life
bad.
Was not awful. I have to say, but. Okay, so I'm going to bring my mother in it. My parents were married happily, unhappily, until I was about 15, and then they divorced. And we don't have to go into the why, but they divorced, and I lived with my mom. They were amicable divorced, so they talked to each other. They were not each other's enemies and stuff like that. So everything was okay, except they were not married. So I'm with my mother, and my mother was a computer analyst. She worked with computers. She was no dummy, and she had a access to a copy machine, which was not usual in Czechoslovakia at that time. So that brings us to an interesting thing.
And this is the 70s.
This is after the 1968. Yes, okay. This is the 70s when the dissidents started to put their heads up a little bit more, like Václav Havel and a few others, and. So what she was not a dissident. She was not a known person, but she was a person that was able to make copies of these manifestos or articles and stuff like that. And that was priceless. So people, she did not know Václav Havel. She did not know any of them, but somehow it got to her and said, "Could you make 50 copies or 100 copies of this?" And she was able to do that, okay? That's not the reason why she decided to defect, but her reasoning was that she could not go in the company that she worked for any further up than she got to at the moment, because maybe I don't think because she was a woman, but because she was politically undesirable. Let's say, mm-hmm. You know what I mean. It was the same thing, for everything.
So she was printing information about Czechoslovakian freedom or opposition to Soviet opposition, rule, to communist rule.
Yeah.
And so, and you know, that's
kind of a no-no. That's a dangerous thing to do.
Well, I thought, you know, what jumped to my mind was the role of printing and like the printing press and the Gutenberg and
if
all
you
that.
Have a
you have
press,
a printing press.
You have a lot of power.
And I thought about photography and the importance of being able to spread, because she could spread information more rapidly than anyone else.
More rapidly than everybody. They also wrote it. They wrote it on a carbon paper. So you make one copy, or maybe two or three, but still, you have to write it. So for her, I mean, to them, she was totally priceless.
Interesting.
Okay? Yeah. And I have to say that the company and the people there, they started to know about it, and they started to kind of bring down their neck, mm-hmm. her neck, and she felt that they would probably find her out, and she would be in trouble.
Okay? Was it a government?
Everything was government owned, even this company.
Right.
So her bosses, her immediate bosses covered for her, but they only could do so much. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And then eventually she was afraid that something would happen. So this was in the late 70s. Okay. We defected in 1980. So you're talking late 70s when the Charter 77 and all these other things were going on in Czechoslovakia. Just in case you want to know about Charter 77, look it up, because I don't remember either.
Interesting.
But it was a proclamation by the dissidents, by the people who wanted free Czechoslovakia. It was a proclamation to make Czechoslovakia free and open again, not communist. Mm. All right. And of course, the communist government, am I speaking too fast?
No.
The communist government didn't like it at all. So Charter 77, and then 78, 79, she was very active. And in 1980, she decided that she's going to go. Okay.
So you were aware of her kind of opposition
you were aware. Yeah, everybody was. Let me tell you one thing too. My friends, I had about, let's say, we had about 20 people in class. Then I went to high school, the school after that, what would you call it? Community college, maybe. It's hard to compare those things. It was like a lyceum. And we had about 25, and most of us, no matter what the authorities told us, we knew what was going on, because our grandparents knew. They passed it down to their kids, our parents, and our parents told us. So we knew, and we of course knew that communism is not very good.
Were your teachers pushing?
Of course, they had to. Yeah. They had to. It was their job. So we knew that they a lot of times did it with wink, wink. Okay, because they knew that we know, and we knew that they know. But we had to play the game.
Interesting.
Because there was always two or three communists in the class who would probably turn the teacher in. Mm-hmm. So the teacher had to act certain way. But we all knew what was going on. Okay. So where was I?
You're getting ready to leave.
Yes. So my mom decided.
But your mother. I'm sorry to interrupt, but your mother was never was afraid of being arrested or anything.
No. Okay. No, she was not in immediate danger. Nobody ever hauled her away from our house. Nothing like that, really.
Did that occur?
To others? Others. Yes. Yeah. To others, yeah. They hauled Havel to jail all the time and other people, but not my mother. Maybe it was luck. Maybe it was some, who knows? Okay. But she didn't. But at the same time, a friend of hers who defected in 1968 to New York contacted his friend, who was also my mother's friend from school. And he was a single guy who all of a sudden started to communicate with my mother. And they knew each other. They were kind of attracted to each other when they were in school. So my mother decided to make the short story short that she would probably go. He kind of invited her. He says, you know, Jana, would you like to defect? And if you like me, we could get married. And if not, I'll help you. Anyway, okay. So in the summer of 1980, she decided that she would do it. She would actually go and give it a shot.
Okay? This is all by mail.
And he actually called from Canada. He defected to Canada. He's not my stepfather, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah, so everything ended up just fine for them.
Awesome.
And so he called a few times, and I handed her a phone, closed my ears, and everything. And they were talking for hours. So she decided that she will go. Now, when you want to travel from a communist country to other countries, it's a big deal. Okay. Now, just to make sure that you understand, within the Warsaw Bloc, which was East Germany, Hungary, Poland, what else?
Romania,
Bulgaria, and those. You can travel with your Czech passport, with no problem at all.
Any of those?
No, yeah. With my friends, we went to East Germany, to the North Sea all the time. It was about 2 days worth of driving, but we went there all the time. And all you need to do at the border is to show your passport. You got a stamp and you went, no problem at all. But if you want to go to Yugoslavia, that's a different story. At that time, Joseph Broz Tito was still in power in Yugoslavia. So Yugoslavia was kind of half communist, half capitalist. And that was very suspicious.
I would have wondered about that.
Yeah. And that's why they didn't want us to go like that to Yugoslavia. We also knew that from Yugoslavia, it's easier to cross the border to Austria. To the west, okay.
Yes.
So we.
Why did Stalin? I mean, yeah. Why did the Soviets tolerate Yugoslavia being sort of communist?
I don't think that they could really take it over. They didn't. They didn't. It would be a PR nightmare at that time.
Too many ethnicities.
And Tito was one of them.
Yeah.
Marshal Tito was one of them. He was Stalin's equal. So maybe the Brezhnev people say, you know, we cannot really go there.
Interesting.
Because this guy is one of them.
Yeah.
He's like Mao Zedong, one of the guys.
Yeah.
All right.
Interesting.
So that's possibly who knows? Because after Tito, it all went to shambles, as you know.
I know.
All right. But we, thank God, we were praying. We're not terribly religious, but we were like, please, Tito, stay alive for another month. You know, because he was in bad shape at that time in 1980. He was like, he was going to die any moment. And we knew that that would be trouble. Okay. So, yeah, that was funny. So back to the traveling. If you want to travel from communist Czechoslovakia, you need hard currency, so that you will not go there and start begging people for. They want to make sure that, I'm not sure if they want to make sure that you present Czechoslovakia in good light or not, or whether it was something else. But you needed, let's say, 50 German marks per day. So if we went for a 14-day vacation to Yugoslavia, to the Adriatic Sea, we needed 14 days times 50 marks worth of money. Not easy. It was a lot of Czech crowns. Okay, So that's the first thing you need. So my mother sold some family silverware that we had and got the money and brought it to the bank. And the bank actually gave her the German marks that she needed. And she brought it to the bureaucrats, whoever they are, who decide whether she can go or not. And they said, well, you've got the money, you got the time. So they gave her the stamp that she could actually travel out of Czechoslovakia into Yugoslavia. Mm. Then she had to go to the Yugoslavian embassy and get a visa that she can actually go in.
Could she have gone directly to Vienna? No.
Well, people used to run across the borders, but we didn't want to do it that way. Yes, you could. But there's the border between East and West was just like they have, it's in the movies. Yeah, we're just kind of going back and there. But between the southern Bohemia and Austria, there's about 30-mile or 30-kilometer strip of land where they will start stopping you on every road. Mm-hmm. So if you want to hoof it, if you want to go with a backpack, you could probably sneak through. But then you run into that area where there's sand and landmines. You don't want to do that.
No.
You need somebody to help you. You don't want to do that. But it's possible. People had done it, but it's not advisable. We knew that.
So you got approved to go to Yugoslavia.
So my mother got approved. And so I said, okay, so I'm going to be here in Czechoslovakia. She's going to send me some Canadian dollars and I'm going to be living on the hog. I'll be like the rich
guy. You know she's leaving.
I knew it. Okay. Yeah, I knew it. My father didn't. He didn't tell her because he was my father. He didn't. I was his son. He didn't want me to go. He didn't want me to go. So anyway, so I was like, okay, my mother will go to Canada. She'll send me money and I'll be living like a king here, you know. And then as the time of her departure was coming closer and closer, I said, wait a minute, I'm going to be here without mom. No mom. And I panicked. I didn't panic, but I said, you know, maybe I should go too.
Did she give you that option?
Yes. Yeah. I didn't take it at first. So about a month after her, we had to go through the same process again for me. And because I needed a stamp from my employer, I didn't have an employer, but I was between schools. I just finished the one and I was going to go to the university. I was able to find, by total chance, I went to my previous school and I still belong there because I didn't start the other one, the new one yet. The dean of students was there. And he says, how did you find me? I'm here like one day a month. And I said, I don't know, dumb luck. Can you give me a stamp? And he looked at me, because he knew, and he gave me a stamp and he signed it that I can go. And he knew that I was going to, everybody had that look on their faces when they knew something, mm-hmm. But he didn't mind. And he signed it for me and I got the German marks and I got the stamps to go out and to go to Yugoslavia with my mother. Yeah. So we were all set to go. Yeah. So this is what we had to do. We actually had to go. Normally, if you look at the map of Europe, you will see that Bohemia or Czechoslovakia is above Austria. So the fastest way to go from Prague to Yugoslavia would be to go to the southern Bohemia, cross the border, go to Vienna, then cross Austria, and you're in Yugoslavia. Mm. Easiest way to go, but we couldn't do that because that would require us, the Czechs, to let us go into Austria, and that was a no-no, okay? So we had to go from Czechoslovakia through Hungary, and which is next to Austria, and then down to Yugoslavia. Okay, so there's a train that does that. So one day we just kind of we had the tickets, and we just my best friend Alex, who's my son and named after, my best friend Alex is the only one that knew that we're going. So he actually came on a platform.
Did your mother have to have a reason? She'd say vacation?
Vacation. Well, just vacation. Yeah, that's enough. That was good enough. People used to go to Yugoslavia all the time.
Yeah.
This was just, we were a little nervous about it, that's all. And I remember buying on the black market about $500, which was also a huge amount of money. And I did not smoke, but I bought a pack of Camels. And I let the tobacco out of the Camels, rolled up the $100 bills,
and
put the tobacco back in.
Wow.
So they wouldn't find them at the border, because they really, they searched you on the border, whether you were leaving or coming. Yeah. And I have a tick even today. When I go to Canada, about 10 miles before Champlain, up there up north, I get nervous. I take my glasses off. I make myself presentable. I get passports ready.
Interesting.
And Janet, my wife, says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I don't know. That's what I do."
Yeah.
And she's used to it by now. But it's like, I get very nervous at any border.
Yeah, I get nervous at borders too.
Oh, you do? Yeah, so that's maybe not just me. Okay. Anyway, so we took a train. It was a pleasant trip from Czechoslovakia through Hungarian border, then another Hungarian border, and then Yugoslavia. And we ended up in Belgrade, actually, believe it or not. And in Belgrade, believe it or not, there's a tall, balding man with a rose in his hand. And that was my future stepfather, waiting for my mother.
Hmm.
So he came. He was able to come as a Canadian citizen. He was able to actually come to Yugoslavia, and he did. And he knew when the train is coming, and he was waiting there for us.
When did you know you were okay? When was it the point where you kind of went,
Not yet. So Peter, what he did was he had a rental for us at the ocean, at the sea, at the Adriatic Sea in Split or somewhere like that. Beautiful place. And so so we stay there for 14 days. Okay, 14 days. And I had a ball.
And that was the intent. That was the length of
the there. Or we stayed for 14 days, even though, after about a week, he says, "Václav, let's go for a beer." By the way, for some of you, I was older than 18 by then. And so we went for a beer, and he says, "Your mother decided that she will defect with me to Austria, and then she will come to Canada, and we will see if we can start new life for her there. And the question is, would you like to do the same thing?" And so I said, I need some time. Give me a day. So here comes the famous.
So you thought you were just going to go on vacation. She would defect, and you weren't sure. You might go back.
Sure. I wasn't sure.
But you
sure.
had that out. You could have gone back. Option. You could have gone back.
Option. Yes, I had the option. So he wanted to know whether I'm sure that I want to go. So here comes the famous story about me and a little bottle of rum. So I bought a little bottle of rum, went on the beach, stayed there all night long, and wonder what will be next. Of course, as a young man, I had a girlfriend, all-important girlfriend in Czechoslovakia, in Prague. And I, of course, didn't want to leave her. But then I said, you know what? There'll be another one. You know what I mean? This is not the end of the world. So at the end of the night, I decided that I'm going to go. So the next morning I said, all right, I'm in. Let's go. So, you know, we still stayed a few days. And I guess my mother and him got along all right. So everything was good. And so we decided to go. And we drove to a town named Ljubljana, which is close to the border between Austria and it's close to Vienna. And in Ljubljana, they have Austrian embassy. So what we did was he had a rental. That's how we got there. He says, let's get Austrian visa so it's easier. And I said, oh, my God, they're going to find out. They're going to get us in all sorts of trouble. Well, they didn't. We went into the Austrian embassy, and he says, I would like to get for these my friends a transit visa from here, from Ljubljana, from Yugoslavia to Czechoslovakia. Just transit visa. So we just go, enter, a few hours later we exit, and we're out. They call it transit visa.
But you're going to pass through Vienna or through
just through Austria. Austria. Yeah. You have a few hours in Austria. After that, they're starting to look for you or whatever. I'm not sure how it works. So we got this visa. Then he goes and performs his first act of magic. He calls his cousin, who was an Austrian. And he says, okay, we're ready to go. Pick us up in about 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever. So they picked us up in this huge Mercedes or something like that. It was Georg and his wife, Peter, me, and my mother, comfortably
into the car. How did you get from Yugoslavia into Austria?
We're getting in there.
Okay.
Okay. So we are now in Yugoslavia, and we are all five of us in a big car with Austrian license plates, and we are ready to roll into Austria. Now, they all knew, Peter and Georg and his wife, they all knew that the best way to cross the border is to go like in a wee hours of the day, of the night, like at 2, when the border crossing patrols are like, you know, woozy a little bit, and they really don't want to deal with anything. So we waited for a long time until the night came. And so the rest of it was, driving up to the border was uneventful. And so we come up, of course, and there is the Yugoslavian border patrol, a big guy with machine gun, okay? And you have to stop in both Yugoslavian and Austrian. So the Yugoslavian guy says, okay, so where are you going? He talks to the driver and he says, we're going to Vienna. And who do you have in the car? And he says, I have my friend Peter and his friend Jana and Václav. And he says, passports. So we gave them all the passports and he looks at them and he says, 2 Austrian, 1 Canadian, and 2 Czech. He looks at it, shakes his head and goes into the little shack that they have there and to check them. And I'm not sure what he was doing there, if he really checked them or if he didn't feel like it. So he was just sitting there for a while. Then he comes back, rolls down the window, throws the passports inside and says, go. And at that moment, we were free, right? But I'll tell you, sitting in that car for those 5 minutes, I was there with my next to my mother, and Peter was on that side, my mother and me. It was like a huge hand squeezing your stomach. It's like, what the heck is going to happen next? Mm-hmm. You know, are they going to lock us up, catch us, send us back, or what? You know. And then when he gave us the passport back, and Georg didn't miss anything, he went boom and away he went.
And then you had to go to the Austrian border.
Okay, then we go to the Austrian border. And what you need to do is to tell them, why are you coming? Not them, because we're going home. So Georg says, well, we're going home and we're bringing defectors. And so that's no problem. He said, we have 1 Canadian, no problem, and 2 defectors. And they said, sir, you have to approach the first police station that you run into when they're open and declare for political asylum. Okay, that's how it's done, which everybody... Peter and them, they knew that, but the border patrol told us anyway, and they gave us the stamps and they let us in. Okay, so that was no problem at all. But you know, I'm not trying to make a light of it, because they were friends who came after me and who were crossing the same border on foot or in buses, and they were caught and turned back repeatedly. So somehow, I think that because we had the help of the Austrian guy with the Austrian car, we sailed through this fairly easy. You know
who
what
got
saying?
Turned back?
My other friends who came after me, people that I know, they tried to do the same thing. They tried to cross the border from Yugoslavia to Austria, and they were caught. They were stopped by border patrol, and they looked at their passport, says back. They wouldn't let them in. I mean, they wouldn't let them out. They wouldn't let him out.
Yugoslavia.
So in a way, we were lucky, okay? Or whatever. You make your own luck, right? So I guess we made our own luck in a way.
Did they ever arrest the people, or they just say,
no,
get
they
back.
Send them back. Yeah, they send them back. What happened was that Peter had friends in in Vienna, and they actually set it up for us so that early morning, this is like wee hours in the morning, by 7 o'clock in the morning, we were in Vienna, and we did not stop at any station. We just went straight to Vienna, to the main camp for refugees, which was Dreiskirchen. It's somewhere east, southeast of Vienna. And so we declared that we were there. They were waiting for us, actually, because his friend set it up for us. And they started the process of debriefing us because they want to debrief you about what you know, right? So my mother knew a lot more than I did. I was just a 20-year-old who was living, you know, okay life at the moment. My biggest problem was that I could not read the books that I wanted to read. I could not watch the movies that I wanted to watch. I could not go to the places that I wanted to watch, unless it was during my swim meets. And so we were with the swimming. I did get to go to the West, but we were watched, and they always make sure that we came back. Okay, so
where did you go to swim?
Usually Austria, Hungary, and places like that. Not far. So anyway, they were waiting for us, and they debriefed us. And then they told us that the Dreiskirchen at that moment was full, so they will have to put us up in South Bohemia, south of Vienna, in a small village named Mödling. And there's a hotel, Zwei Raben, which is two crows, and the hotels were not doing too well when there's an off-season, so they rented rooms for refugees. So we ended up in this beautiful, picturesque place. My mother had her own room. I had my own room. So that's where we ended up. Now Peter flew back to Canada because he had nothing else to do there. Okay, so he flew home, and my mother went on to the Canadian embassy for interview. They do physical. They make sure that you don't have STD. They make sure that you are physically okay, that you are mentally okay. There was a lot of blood tests that we are not some kind of whatever you would call it, bad people or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know, sick people, you know. So they also send our names to Interpol. And no matter what the country is, even if it's communist country, they all have agreements with Interpol. And Interpol is an international police agency, and they want to know whether we are criminals, okay? And we came out of Interpol, we came clear. We were not criminals. So they said, okay, good. So let's proceed. So my mother went to Canadian embassy for interview, and she declared that she's going to be married to Peter. So her paperwork took only like 3 months, and she was out. Okay, my paperwork took longer because Peter and my mother and other people were telling me that I might be better off going to the United States because there's more opportunities. I have to say that they were right. Okay, it's a land of opportunity. I could have done whatever I wanted to do. So I said, okay, you know what? I'll go. That sounds good to me. There was also a little thing in the back of my mind, and that was that there was an agreement from 1918 between United States and Czechoslovakia. And it said that as soon as Czechoslovakian citizen or Czech citizen becomes American, he or she automatically loses Czech citizenship, which means that the laws of Czechoslovakia do not apply anymore, which means that they, as an American citizen of Czechoslovakian descent, I could apply for visa and go and visit my father. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
That was important to me. So because I wanted to go back.
I was going
to
ask you about that too.
I wanted to go back.
Yes.
To visit.
And so you thought about that. Yes. So you did not. I was wondering whether you thought that I will never ever get back, but you thought I would go back.
Yes.
Even when you're in Austria.
I was hoping.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that way you're not I see. So you're no longer a Czech citizen.
Yes.
United States citizen. And you thought that would give you some protection.
Yes.
If you went back, that they couldn't.
People had done it and it worked. It worked. Yeah. So.
Whereas Canadian citizenship would not.
No. You would still have dual citizenship and they could say, hey, you're still a citizen.
Interesting.
Guess what? You're going in jail for a year or something like that. So I decided to go to the United States. So again, just like my mother, I went for about two or three interviews at the embassy. Was checked out and everything like that. And then you just kind of wait. The paperwork is sent to Washington, D.C., and I think Congress decides or somebody. I'm a little hazy on that, but it took me half a year. We got there at the end of August, And my flight to New York City was on February 24th. So,
and your mother took only 3 months.
Yes, because she was getting married.
Oh, I see.
She was going, she had a sponsor who was not only a sponsor, but he was like, yeah, I'm taking her.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
I had a sponsor. You have to have a sponsor, which was that old friend of family that that put my mother in contact with Peter. He lived in New York City, and he was really well off. So the first few months in New York City were awesome. Right. I lived on Manhattan, and I was the king of Manhattan.
Really?
You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. I was having a good time.
Did you have to pay for your own flight?
Okay, it works like this. The Austrians do not pay for all this. The taxpayers do not pay for all this, despite of what people think. It's organizations. There are like I was sponsored by American Federation for Czech Refugees or something like that. It's an American organization from Czechs like me who chip in, pay some dues, pay some money, and it goes overseas to help people like me.
Very interesting.
So I was sponsored by them. I was helped by them, even though I think that Americans helped a lot with the army surplus. I for the winter, because winter was coming, I got coats and pants that were definitely military issue of U.S. military issue. So that was interesting.
And you were living in Manhattan in a rich guy's house.
In a rich guy's house. But wait, let's go back to Vienna still.
Okay.
Let's go back to
Why
Vienna.
Not?
We'll get to Manhattan again.
All right.
So now my mother and me are still in the hotel there and kind of waiting. You know, there's no real jobs. There's nothing to do, so you read, you listen to the radio, you go for walks and stuff like that. And almost immediately, I would like to introduce the listeners to an interesting phenomena, which is the defector's dream, which you have anywhere from half a year to maybe 3 years. And this is how it goes: you go for a walk in a deserted part of woods somewhere in a like a park. On the road, and you go for a walk. You decided to go for a nice stroll, and you go, and all of a sudden you sense that somebody's behind you. And there's a bunch of guys, like two or three of them, you know, big guys going behind you. And they are coming closer and closer and closer. And so you try to make it look like nothing is going on, but you're going faster and faster and faster until you run and run, and then they jump at you, and then you wake up before they catch you. It's a dream that a lot of immigrants or defectors actually have, because they are afraid that they'll be caught by the Czech authorities and dragged back to Czechoslovakia or so wherever they came from.
Almost like PTSD.
It took me a while to get. It was not every night. It was not every night, but it came sometimes.
The same one.
With vengeance. Yeah. So that was interesting. Now on top of it. We made some friends because the hotel was small, but it was full of immigrants like us. And a lot of them was, of course, Czech. Some of them were Polish. And there was a Czech couple who says, we're flying out in about a week. And our employer, a restaurant in town, was wondering whether we would bring somebody over who could work, like, you know, clean the floors, wash dishes and stuff like that. Would you like to do that? And I said, what am I going to do? Sit here for 6 months? So I said, yeah. So I went there. And my mother and me started to work for Mr. Ott, who was the owner of the Heurige, which is a cellar, wine cellar, mm-hmm. that said about 200. It was not a small place. It was okay. So my mother washed the floors, and I washed the dishes. And then eventually, I remember that within about a month, I was not only washing dishes, but I started to make salads for him. And then later I was starting to cook spare ribs. Okay. Then later I was selling the, he says, tomorrow, Wendel, he called me Wendel, which is the German name for Václav. He says, Wendel, tomorrow you're going to be selling salad. And I said, how am I going to do that? I speak very little German. I did speak German, but I was not comfortable. And he says, don't worry about it. I worked when I was younger, I worked on Swedish cruise ship. And I cooked in the middle of this big dining room, open cooking. And people who were there, they were from, you know, Sweden, Finland, United States, everywhere. They were coming in and they were talking to me in all sorts of languages. And we always made it work. Don't worry about it. Tomorrow you're selling. So I'm there behind the counter, and I not only. So we were all like taking turns in washing the dishes, cooking, doing this, that, and it was fun. So I did, and after the first day, you know, he said, "You're natural. Just keep going. You're doing fine." And there's one thing that's very interesting. There was a Mexican ambassador to Austria. At least that's how he identified himself. And he was always with some sharp looking guys. So I have no reason to believe that it wasn't him. He frequented the Heurige, and he always ordered the spare ribs, which is a bunch of rack of ribs,
yep,
done with some spices.
Sure.
And he, once I made it for him, and he says, "Wendell, I don't want it from him. That was Mr. O. I want him from you from now on." So I was the only one who was allowed to make him.
And this is now this is south of Vienna.
Yes, in Mödling, in a small town. Yeah. And
so in the short 3 months, your mom was there. In the 6 months, you guys got jobs.
My mother left after that, and I was there alone.
Still working.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm still there, and we hired another person to clean the floors. And then his wife, Mr. Ott's wife, owned actually a small shop in town, and they had four young boys, between 15 and 10. And she came once and she says, "Wendell, this is interesting. We're going on vacation to Italy. First time my husband is taking time off. You know why? Because he trusts you." And I ran the place for 14 days. All by myself. I had a waitress. I had a waitress and I had a cleaner. And the waitress was an older woman, friend of his. Of course, she was there to keep eye on me. I get that. Yeah. But I was doing the shopping. I was doing everything for 14 days, and the place survived it. So I had a little bit of my grandfather in me, I think, from the business of making food. You know what I'm saying?
Did everybody say, "Where's Otto?"
No, they knew. They just told him, "I was on vacation."
That's great.
So it was pretty cool. And he also insisted on speaking to me in English, because he says, "You have to practice. So I'm going to talk to you in English, and you do the best you can to answer me, because I need to train you for when you go to United
Interesting.
States. So he was pretty good about it. Yeah.
Did you ever get to see him ever again after you left?
I tried. This is the funniest thing. So I'm in 1986, I went back to Austria with my friend Alex, who, by the way, defected a few years after me. The guy that saw me away on my friend Alex, he defected to Germany. So I went to visit him in 1986 before I went to college to become a teacher in the summer. And we went to Austria, to Vienna, and we were wondering what happened to Mr. Ott. And they said, "He just sold the business and he moved." And we couldn't find him.
Wow.
He just sold it.
That's so
Because wild. He was getting a little older.
Of course, though. Yeah.
So at least you tried. I never saw him again.
At least you tried, yes.
Yeah, that was funny.
So now your mom is in Canada.
My mother's Canada.
And you are in Manhattan.
Not yet. So I'm still in Austria. So finally, can I go a little more into
Of course.
That? Okay. So comes Christmas. My uncle, my uncle finds out that I'm in Austria. My mother told him. My uncle lives in Switzerland. My uncle is her cousin.
Okay.
So it's a little bit stretch, but everybody's uncle and aunt. Right. You know that. You know how it works. So he says, and he has a son who is about 10 years older than me. He's 10 years younger than my mother. So he's like in between. Major pothead. And he says, "Come for Christmas to Zurich. We'll have fun." So I went to the authorities where I was in that hotel. There's always somebody there. I said, "Can I go to Zurich?" And they said, "Okay, we will have to give you a passport and get you passport that only lasts for like a year."
Visa?
Or two.
Not a
yeah,
visa.
No, like a passport.
Yeah.
It's not an Austrian passport. It's just a passport for somebody to travel, immigrant or defector. So they did actually. They gave me a passport, and then I went to Swiss embassy. They gave me a stamp, and on the train I was for Christmas. So I went from Austria to from Vienna to Zurich, and I was in a train compartment with a bunch of guys, and one of them was a Jewish guy from Israel, and one of them was Iranian guy. You should see those conversations, because at that time, if you remember, Reagan was just about to be the hostage crisis in the Iranian embassy was going on. They were going at it. Okay. It was politics back and forth. And I'm like sitting there like, okay, whatever. I hope that they're not going to start fighting with each other physically, you know.
They're small. That's a small space to be in, too. Yeah.
But they all survived. They were arguing, but they were not violent. It was an interesting thing to listen to. I don't remember any of it, but I know that they were on different sides of the issue at the moment. Yeah. Right. So I went to Zurich to visit my uncle, and my cousin took me to Zermatt. I don't know. That's where Matterhorn is, to ski, because that's where they went every winter. So my cousin, the younger son of the uncle, and his group of friends, who were the last hippies, probably, that you know of, you know, long heads, all PhDs in rocket science. They always worked for Department of Defense in Zurich. And then they just 2 years, nothing. And then they went back to work, and then nothing. That's what they did. They liked it. And so they took me to Zermatt to be with them and to ski. So I skied at 4,000 meters above sea level. That's 12,000 feet on Little Matterhorn, they call it. And so I was there with them for about 14 days, having a pretty decent time.
Did you ski in Czechoslovakia?
Yes, I did. I knew how to ski. Yeah, that was not a problem. Yeah. But all the skiing is there. It was so easy, at least the way we did.
Yeah.
And so I had a nice vacation with my family that I actually met only once or twice in my life before. So then I went back, and by February, I got papers saying you were okay. Your flight is on February 24th, and you're going to JFK, and that's where Milos, my sponsor, will be waiting for you.
Wow. Yeah. That's exciting.
That was the end of it.
That's amazing. And
it was my first time in an airplane, in jumbo jet. So I'm like, you know, we taxiing in Vienna at the airport. We're taxiing. Going, you know, like 150 miles. I said, this is okay. And all of a sudden, the thing just takes off. And I said, how in the devil is this possible? You know what I mean?
That's great.
So, yeah. So it was DWA. They don't exist anymore.
Was New York, like,
oh my God,
overwhelming? Yes. I mean, it was like, I knew, you heard it. You've seen movies and stuff. Yeah. But was it just like, what the heck?
When you go from Czechoslovakia to Austria, to the West, it's one shock. When you go to the stores and IKEA, and you see all these things, you know, 5-6 different types of shampoo and soaps and soda and stuff like that. It's like unbelievable, you know.
Yes.
And then you go to the United States and you have an aisle of shampoos, you know what I mean?
Yes.
You have even more. Everything is bigger. There's plenty of room. And you go, and Milos picked me up and got me into a yellow taxi, which I knew about, and we're all going towards Manhattan. And all of a sudden, it's like, are you freaking kidding me? I'm here. I'm where John Travolta walked in Saturday Night Fever. I'm here. You know, wow. Yeah. It was really something else. I have goosebumps even now.
Thinking about it, yeah. So obviously, coming to New York now, you're in touch with your mom. Of course, she's up in Canada. She's probably happy that you're that you made it. Excited.
So I was in his apartment, and she was able to call me on his landline. On his landline. So we were kind of in touch. But then after about 3 months, he says, you know, I cannot do this forever. You have to go and take care of yourself. And he had a point. So he kind of pushed me out. I don't blame him.
How long was that?
After about 3 months. Okay. So February, March, April. Yeah, something like that. And I witnessed my first St. Patrick's Parade in New York City. That was awesome. Everybody looked like John McEnroe with that curly hair, Irish curly hair, green hair. That was awesome. And so I had to move to Queens, Jamaica Boulevard, which is actually the between Queens and Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in, I rented one room, and I worked in an electronics company, which was my profession. I worked in an electronics company, and believe it or not, they told me, and maybe they were full of it, I don't know, but we were putting together one of the first navigation systems for the space shuttle.
Hmm.
I don't know, but that's what I was told.
Wow.
Okay. I was just doing small parts. Yeah. So I had no idea if that was really true.
Was it in Brooklyn?
It was in Queens.
Queens.
And it was called Axel Electronics. Mm-hmm. What happened to it? I have no idea.
Interesting.
But that's what the bosses told me when they were hiring me. I have no clue if it was really true. And so I was living there. And my mother always wanted me to call her. So I always got a bunch of dimes at that time, and even quarters, put them in a payphone in a bar nearby. And I called her for a few minutes. And she says, "You have no idea how afraid I was and how much I was waiting for that phone call," because she's still my mother, even now, okay? Your parents are always worried about you. So what happened was, what happened was this. I traveled to upstate New York a few times because some of the friends that I met in Austria came here. They had their sponsors and their friends here. So I said, "Come and visit, it's beautiful up here." So so we were able somehow to connect, and I found their address. And so I show up in, I took a Greyhound bus, and I show up in Open. I said, "How do I get to Clifton Park?" They said, "You don't. It's not that easy. I have to come and get you because there's no train.
Trains,
you have to go either by taxi, which is $50, or somebody has to get you."
Yeah.
So they always had to come and get me. Because they lived in Clifton Park Apartments, right by where is now Clifton Park Commons, okay? And that's where I started to visit. I was there about three times. My parents, my Peter and my mother, came from Canada to visit. They took me to the Adirondacks, and I just loved it. I loved the Adirondacks. I loved Saratoga. I loved it. And I said, I'm out of New York City. So by August, I packed up my bags, and I moved here, and I found a job in electronics company again, in Brad Cable Electronics, fixing cable TV converters.
Hmm.
And found an apartment, and that's what brought me into Schenectady.
Interesting.
That's how I ended up in
this
New York
area.
State, in upstate New York. Yeah,
wow.
Now,
I have a question. Did you, what was your feeling when the Soviet Union collapsed? I mean, did you ever in your life think that would occur?
No.
How about the Berlin Wall coming down?
So Soviet Union, maybe. Berlin Wall, never.
Yeah,
never.
I couldn't believe
never.
It either.
None of us ever could. If I knew that the wall will go down in 1989?
Something like that, yeah.
I would probably not defect, I have to say, because you're talking 9 years.
Right.
Okay, 9 years. So in 1980, I would go to school or maybe not. I would be a computer specialist. I would be doing something. Not terribly exciting, but I would be doing something. Would I be a rich man? Probably not. Okay. But if I would be at least free man by 1989.
Right.
So maybe I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Maybe
now,
I wouldn't.
Did you tell me about when you went back to visit your father?
Well, how'd
that work out?
So
was he mad at you?
No, he got over it. Yeah. He held the apartment that my mother and me lived in. He held it for 3 years.
Really?
He paid rent. For 3 years,
no kidding.
Because he was hoping that I will change my mind and come back.
Hmm.
By the way, we were both tried in absentia, and we all both got a year and a half in jail. So if we came back without, just like that, we would have to sit in jail for a year and a half. Yeah, which is not, I mean, it's not that terrible, but it was a jail sentence.
But nothing against your family or anyone?
No, my father came out of it all right, because he didn't know.
Right.
And that's why we did it. We did not want anybody to know. Because if they know, they're accomplices.
Was he
right?
Questioned and stuff? Your dad?
I'm not sure. He never told me.
That's
he never told me. I should ask him before he dies.
Yeah.
Nobody got into
And you've
real
been
trouble.
Back many times.
Many times since. But the first time was the interesting one because it was still 1989. Václav Havel was the president. It was exciting. It was exciting, and we went through the border between. My friends were picking me up in Austria, in Vienna, at the airport. For some reason, we decided to fly to Vienna, and we are going and crossing the hard border between Austria and Czechoslovakia, and it's like I'm going home.
That's great.
And the border patrol looks at my American passport and says, look at my name and says, welcome home.
That's great.
Because recognize the Czech name. Right?
That's wonderful, Vasa. Yeah.
So it was good.
Yeah, and I'm sure we have a lot more to tell stories of, but we are at the end of the time.
Yeah.
And we did a full hour of us, which is really long.
If you want to continue sometimes, I have more.
I will.
We have more because we still have to come. No, we don't have to. But
well, you know what will happen is when we post this, when I send this out here and people listen to it, they'll send me back questions and then we'll do a second follow-up.
No problem.
So thank you very much. That was Václav Satola's story about his coming to America, and a really exciting story. I'm excited for it. And it will be the next episode of Stories Past. And that's another episode of Stories Past, a collection of personal experiences that I've told to my students over the last 4 decades. I've chosen these stories because they were funny, inspirational, or maybe amazing. Please keep a lookout for more upcoming episodes or go back and binge the stories you missed if you want. This is Blake Smith, and you've just been told one of my Stories Past.